Session number 31680, Reel 4.
Back to the UK, and they then sent me to another elementary school on a flying school on Tiger Moths at Panshanger, which is at Hatfield, where the Havillands are, just to familiarise yourself with the English countryside, because after the section lines that went north, south, and east, west in Canada. There were suddenly lots of little tiny fields and ponds and villages, and I suppose they thought you ought to become familiar with that. And I also think that they were probably filling in our time in a way of because they didn't want us to move to the next stage, really, which was Little Rissington on Oxfords again. I remember going to this place, Smith's Lawn, which is in Windsor Park, which I think in order to show that the royal family were playing their part. Smith's Lawn, which is now used for polo, we landed there in our little Tiger Moths, really, and then flew back. It was just a cross-country, XC, presumably cross-country.
When was it that you returned to Britain?
When was it that what?
When was it that you returned to Britain?
To Britain. Well, and... GR school, well, it was then January, that says 43, it was 44, January 44, 29th of January. But then I must have been hanging around, yes, I know what happened. They kept, people were going on all sorts of courses, I think, to fill in time, and what happened, having come back, through Moncton, the dispatch centre, and then to Halifax, and I came back on the New Amsterdam, a Holland-America line cruise ship, really, that there were 18 of us in a cabin for two. I was on the top bunk, and the ceiling was there, and some chap, a guardsman who'd been on this ship before, had put his number, rank and name, and underneath private so-and-so, they put roll on death. At any rate, from Moncton we came to Harrogate, where we were dispatched, and I went to a thing called Aircrew Officer School, which I think was a fill-in thing. There were hundreds of us there in the Butlins holiday camp, which had been taken over, and we lived in these chalets. I was with an Argentinian volunteer friend, then called, I used to call him Pancho Crisp, and we learned very peculiar things there. We learned how to use revolvers and hand grenades, and pull pins out of hand grenades and throw them so this thing flies off the fuse, burns and goes bang. So we learned a number of I don't know, they were useless things, but they were they weren't strictly Air Force things. And we wore a different sort of, we wore denim trousers and little anklets, I know, when we were doing that. And we also learnt, we also were given the job of talking about almost anything we wanted to the assembled group of people, which was my first coming across these kind of techniques that one comes across later in life, really. And from there, from there, I went to Little Rissington, and it was by then July 1944, and the D-Day had started, and we felt we were being just held back, really, because they didn't want us at that stage. So much was going on across the Channel, and the Americans were all in the western part of England, and at Little Rissington, which they had the brand new Oxfords in marvellous condition, and I really became, I thought, much better at flying at Rissington, and I also did Yes, this is all Rissington stuff. Number 6 pilot advanced flying unit. I did a night flying course for so long, also at Rissington, and a thing called a beam approach school at Pershaw, which was really letting yourself down in with not being able to see anything and, by means of transmissions of, you know, like dots and dashes and going over outer markers and inner markers and dropping your altitude as you approach. Yes,
Have you found conditions in Britain much changed since the...
Since I came back, well, before I came back. Well, I think I became more aware that there was rationing and things were more difficult by then when I went home. And... but in the... how we were fed in the messes didn't seem to, you know, there seemed to be bacon and eggs and things at breakfast, so I don't think other things worried us too much. I'd been commissioned when I finished my training at Moose Jaw. I mean, been top of the course, perhaps 10 or so would be commissioned, the rest would become sergeant pilots. And I think life was quite pretty reasonable, I think, in Gloucestershire at Little Rissington, really. And I became very much more confident in my flying, although I'd got above averages before. I wasn't sure that you know, it was all going to work out because of various engine failures and this, that and the other. But at Rissington, I thought, gosh, these aircraft are marvellous, aren't they? Even though they had some of the Oxford's characteristics, they were Oxford still. And I see on one occasion, I got a lift with the air transport auxiliary. I met a chap in the mess. And he said, I said, what are you flying? He said, I'm flying a Wellington up to Cumbria. I said, oh, I wonder if I could get a lift up with him, go and see my parents. So I went and saw the flight commander. He said, okay. I got in this Wellington, you know, just him and me, and we went up to this place, Kirkbride, which was a maintenance unit. And on the Sunday, the 10th of September, I went back to my father, who had saved a bit of petrol, I think, from his business, ran me back to Kirkbride, this maintenance unit, and I said, what have you got going south? Anywhere near Little Rissington? And then one chap said, we've got a Mitchell, North American Mitchell 3, that's going to a factory at what is now Swindon, at South Marsden, flown by air transport auxiliary, flight seated, flight commander Rogers. I got in this aircraft. There was a third fellow, also ATA pilot, and they had a ring binder with circular rings, which I wasn't too familiar with. And he opened it, and it said North American Mitchell. And then every other page was something else. So I said, haven't you flown with these before? No, I said, we always fly just for flying, just for... So he went out the end of the runway and opened it to this thing. It said, open gills, just flap so much. He did all the things, but I thought, well, he must be pretty self-assured chap to do this. And he opened the engines. Some of the techniques were new to me. He opened the engines pretty well full boost, and it was sort of rocking on the brakes like this, and then he let the brakes off, and it went like a rocket. And before I knew, we were up in the air, and we were over the edge of Cumbria, out over the Irish Sea, and he came down over Walney Island, which is near Barrow in Furness, right down onto the deck, and then I saw in the distance Blackpool, and there were the three piers. And they'd taken the centre of the piers out to prevent invasion by the Germans. It'd been a long way around, but anyway, they'd taken piers down, centres out all around the country. He went right down onto the sands. It didn't actually go through these slots, I don't know. He must have pulled over the piers. But I thought, oh, this man is a... either he's a very good pilot or he's slightly mad. At any rate, he flew over that and then pulled up over Liverpool, which was getting rather murky. And then he said, how long are the runways at Little Rissington? I said, 1,400 yards. He said, I don't know that I can get in to that. He said, I'll have to take you to where we're supposed to be going, and you'll have to hitchhike back from Swindon or from South Marsden. South Marsden was owned by Vickers then, and they were going to do something to this Mitchell. So he arrived at South Marsden, where there was no runway, but a lot of this metal Sommerfeld tracking. And he comes in towards this, and we were halfway along this Sommerfeld tracking, and we hadn't got down on the ground yet, and I thought, I couldn't say anything. I thought he ought to be going around again, really, opening up. But at that point, he hit the ground, pulled all the throttles back, and we all lurched forward like this, and he stopped just before some trees, and then we taxied back, and I got off and got some kind of a bus to Cheltenham, remember, and then from Cheltenham to Little Rissington. I seem to be have a desire to want to fly and under any circumstances. And looking back, I think I should have thought you oughtn't to go with the Air Transport Auxiliary again. They were great chaps, I think. They were obviously old hands who were willing to have a go at flying anything. And there were a lot of women involved in flying in the ATA, although in fact, the number of women who are mentioned means that the men who were in ATA don't they get much of a mention at all, really, although they were probably good. The sort of chaps who I met one a lot later when I did sort of reserve flying after the war on Sunderlands, who said he was doing this on Sunderlands because he'd been at the Central Flying School where they taught you to fly everything. The only thing he hadn't flown was Sunderland. And he had a lot of methods that I had never thought of. Like if you're approaching a boy to pick up a sort of loop from the boy to go on a bollard so you could stop and cut the engines and get shore on boats. You have to sometimes approach it asymmetrically with the wind, the tide one way and the wind the other. So flying boats are all a bit of a tricky situation. Instead of some of the methods we use, which were even putting a drogue out, he just kept cutting the switches on the engines, just operating the two outer engines, cutting the magneto switches until the engine almost stopped and then putting them on again. And so that took sort of two-thirds of the power off. It was a technique that I'd never met before, but he'd done everything with every aircraft. I don't know who he was, but he was, I've got his name in here. I thought there's more to learn about this. I suppose, sometimes I feel I get enthusiastic about flying. I wouldn't have minded doing it, but at any rate, I didn't go on doing it. I better go and visit the loo and let you think. I probably think, I can't let this man go on much longer than me all night.
Going too slowly. How enthusiastic were you at this stage to be getting onto operational flying?
I think I was quite keen, really. At Rissington, I became much more confident about everything, really. I thought, we were told that from Rissington you went on to Wellington's at Moreton in Marsh for so many weeks, then onto Halifax's on a thing called a heavy conversion unit, and then onto Lancaster's for a fortnight on what was called the Lancaster Finishing School, which rather like a finishing school for ladies in Lausanne or somewhere. And we all accepted that was it, and I thought, it's got to be Bomber Command. I was quite prepared. I didn't think there was any alternative, really. Although I look back to the fact that I'd almost been sent onto these liberators in Nassau in the Bahamas. However, an Air Ministry telegram came and picked two of us out of this course at Little Rissington to go on to Sunderland's. And one was a flying instructor who was quite a lot older than me, seemed a lot older, called Watson. who'd done flying instructing. I think he then said, I want to do some operational flying, but he may have said, I want to go on to boats, flying boats, I don't know. And some, in some, I don't know, it might be in Gloucester Records or somewhere, they must be following all this. But I didn't anything very special unless I'd been on this RAF University Air Squadron course, because I did find a number of people who'd been on those courses ended up on Sunderland's, but that could have been just that they had the mental ability to take on this GR course and then perhaps be thought suitable for Sunderland or for flying boats. So we, at any rate, the two of us were posted to this number 131 Coastal Operational Training Unit at Kildees, which is in near Enniskillen on Loch Earn in Northern Ireland. So we got on the train from Little Rissington and went into London and all the way up from London to Scotland out to Stranraer. From Stranraer we got the boat across to Larne, and then we went on some train right across Northern Ireland to County Tyrone, and we were put on a train that left us from a siding, pulled by a horse. There was only one carriage and a horse, and this went up to some little place at the end, which was Kildees. And when we got off at the station there, there were six coffins on the platform, and the chap from the medical officer who apologised to me, said, I'm afraid this was a Catalina crew that crashed last week. I'm sorry to be greeting you with this. Then that was how we arrived. And I remember that night we walked down, because we were so thrilled, I think, to be going on Sunderland, we walked down to the edge of the water where one or two had been pulled out of the water up slipways. They had sort of beaching gear that you could bolt onto the side. People used to go in waders, so sort of fitters and riggers going waders to fix these things to the side, and then a little trolley would go into this bit at the back and they'd pull them up, sometimes with a tractor really, out to service them, perhaps take stuff off the bilges, so things that cling on to the bilges. And we went and looked at the size of about three or four London buses high, and then on this beaching gear. So we thought, well, this is certainly going to be different, but if we can fly the Oxford, we can fly anything. So I went to that, but I was only there, and so was this flying instructor, as a second pilot. I eventually got checked out on Sunderland's and became able to fly them myself. But most of my flying was done with another chap who I still keep in touch with. In fact, I'm going to see him week after next. He lives in High Wycombe, who's been a flying control officer since the war, and whose best man I was when he was married just after the war, Graham Stevens. And he'd done one tour on Sunderland's in West Africa, although you gradually realise when you get to know these people better that it wasn't much of a tour to suddenly become this skipper. He'd only gone two or three flights with a New Zealander, and then somehow he'd been recommended to go on this course, and it was the skipper, and I was his second pilot, although he was lower in rank than me, because he'd been a flight sergeant. He'd become a flying officer when I was a flight lieutenant. At any rate, I liked him very much, and we got on well, and have done ever since, really.
What was your role then as a second pilot?
Well, you sat in the right-hand straight seat, and you chaired the flying, usually an hour on, an hour off. But on takeoffs and landing, you had specific things to do. I mean, you sort of checked with each other what you were going through. But one of the things you did was, there were four engines, and the skipper operated the outer engines, which have most law of moments, most directional effect. And the inner engines just add extra power, but the second pilot has the inner engine. So when you want to take off, you line it up into wind, really, and see that nothing in the way of shipping or anything else.
he would open up the outer engine, perhaps pull one back as it begins to slew a bit, get them going, and then say, okay, so I open the inners, and a terrific boost like a rocket goes off, and then before you know, you're up on the step. That means you're hydroplaning, you're not just going through the water, you're about skimming on the water, and after you've skimmed for so long, the noise of the water drops off and you realise you're airborne, really. I mean, it's a wonderful feeling, really. And we did all these, what were called operational flying exercises, and local bombing and stuff.
What were the operational flying exercises?
Well, they were they were really like going out to meet and patrol with an imaginary convoy coming across the Atlantic. So you'd go up to the Hebrides, to Benbecula or somewhere, and then St. Kilda was one of the islands well out the Atlantic. And then there was a rock that called Rock All, which was even further out. There's nothing but seabirds on it. After that, it was all navigation by the flipping stars, really, by astro navigation, or by radio bearings, of which you couldn't take too many. And dead reckoning, sort of, which way you're going, what is the wind doing. You can find out the wind by throwing a flame float out, a phosphorus flame float. The rear gunner throws it out, and he takes a bearing on it, and then he says what the bearing is, port or starboard, and the navigator is able to work out that although you're heading that way, you're actually going this way. Then if he does three plots on three different directions, 120 degrees difference, you can produce a sort of vector that shows what the wind is, really, because that's where the wind's blowing on that bit, and on this, then you apply the wind to the course you're producing or following on your compass, and it will show by putting a vector for the wind that the track will actually be this. So you can lay off the track, work out a course. If you do this, well, there was a system devised that I was another thing that I was amazed at in the Air Force. It was called a thing called the Coastal Command Navigation Drill. And it was devised by a man called PMS Blackett, who was a professor at Manchester University and allegedly a communist or very left wing, as a lot of intellectuals and academics were at that time, probably quite understandably, really. But at any rate, he became part of the, or perhaps the head of the operational research unit of, I think, of Coastal Command. And he worked out this drill, and all it amounted to was so simple, and yet it was a marvellous thing, because we use it a lot in the Far East. You could do a dead reckoning course, sort of your heading, your course, and your the working out the wind as I've described, and then getting your track. And every hour you'd say, well, my dead reckoning position is there. But at the same time, or just a bit before, you'd take some shots on stars, which would give you another position there. Then you could also take radio bearings, or a thing called LORAN, which is long-range air navigation, which used sort of master stations and slave stations, giving a mark on a specially drawn chart of how long it took for the transmission to reach you. It was all done on an oscilloscope, and that would give you intersecting cuts on these things that would give you this LORAN position. But what Blackett did was say, after 1 hour, that is your dead reckoning, this is your astronavigation, this one is your LORAN system, but all of them will have an error. Some errors will increase with time, like the dead reckoning one, since you left Madras or somewhere. But others will be standard errors. And you drew a circle of these errors. They might not intersect. Either they intersected or they almost intersected. But between it all, you get put a point that was the MPP, the most probable position, which was so simple, really. All of these things weren't quite right, but one was the most probable. Then you'd start again from that most probable for the next hour, and you could fly. We used to fly across the Bay of Bengal very, very slowly, about 90 knots. No, nothing to guide us, really, except for this Loran thing. And you'd come bang out on some island, really. I thought, this man in Manchester is a flipping genius, this communist who'd been sort of rather run down as somebody who wasn't really with us on the right side or something. At any rate, I was always impressed by this Coastal Command navigation bureau.
Would you be able to explain a bit more about the layout of the Sunderland itself and
well,
the cockpit?
Yes, well, it's it has two decks and a bilge. That is to say, the under part of the fuselage has a bilge like a boat has that you just have to pump water out of, really. Then it has two decks. One is the sort of flight deck at the top that has the first and second pilot and the navigator and the wireless operator. And then down below, I don't know if it's shown in this, but down below there are... there was an anchor room at the front where you had a winch, a lot of naval stuff, really, and an actual anchor and mooring gear, a boat hook, etc. Then there was a little lavatory, a yacht lavatory, and then there was a little staircase up to the flight deck, and then behind that was the wardroom, which, I mean, we used it as a general place because we were often carrying ex-prisoners of war back, but perhaps the Navy thought of it as the wardroom where the officers went. Then there was a galley which had a cooker with two primer stoves and a sink and dish racks and so on, all thought up by yachting people or people who knew their naval ways of fitting out all the stowage you get in ships and marine craft. And they had little things that you had drogues in, so you could put a drogue that opened up in the water and kept you from swinging too much to the right if you had this problem with winds and tides when you were approaching a mooring up buoy. And then behind that was a sort of bomb room in which you had stores of depth charges, and they were... They were pulled up electrically onto a lift of electric winches onto sort of bomb racks, and then big doors in the side of the fuselage were pulled in and dropped down, and the racks ran out quite quickly, really. And so you could suddenly have the ability to attack a submarine with them. And a thing that I was quite impressed by was that on one side of the aircraft, this bomb door, which you can see at either Hendon or at Duxford, had an extra section below it, which was bolted on, but the bolts could be undone, and it made the bomb door so much bigger that a whole spare engine could be lifted up on these racks that normally took depth charges and then run into the inside and lowered and taken out. Well, these came into their own in the Far East when some chap, one, it once happened on this Chinwin River thing where they helped the Chindits by flying people out of there. One of the engines failed, so they flew a spare engine up. I mean, it was all done by, I think, yachting enthusiasts who wanted to be self-sufficient. They wanted, apart from getting petrol, they wanted, which you somehow had to get, you could sort of land on an island and cook yourself and moor up yourself and get a spare engine and so on. It was, but it must have been thought out well back into the 30s or before I was born, possibly, as a way of adapting the old Empire flying boats for military use. And I gave them full marks. I mean, an American Catalina, which I've flown in briefly as a passenger, had a lot of interesting ideas, but I think the Sunderland surpassed the Catalina in many ways. much bigger, much more spacious. But the Catalina was an interesting aircraft. I mean, one thing, its throttles were in the roof, which made it a bit... And the control column, instead of having an individual, they had a sort of one that applied to the... worked for the main, the first pilot, and the second pilot, came up as a bar across with your control wheel on, and you had various switches on this bar. It was a simple thing, but somehow the way they designed it, and the floats which prevent the lateral stability on the water on the Catalina folded up onto the ends of the wingtips and became almost streamlined. So on both types of flying boats, a lot of thought had gone in beforehand, more than I think on many aircraft. I think that's why a lot of people are not exactly hanker after them, but they're fond of the memory of them.